And this paper detailed how the CIA's mind control program, MKUltra, was not stopped in 1973, as the CIA had told Congress. Hey guys, it's Jose Galison. You're watching No Way Jose. You can find us on No Way Jose YouTube channel, all the major audio packagers, and Rumble as well. Today, my guest is Austin Picard. We're getting into part 5 of our Jonestown series. I do want to remind you guys how this typically works. If you're a patron, I think I have like 3 or something ridiculous behind the paywall right now. You get these earlier. So if you're catching this when it came out, if you're watching this on the 27th, you're obviously a patron. If not, if you're a poor, I guess. No, I'm just kidding. Obviously, I get it. Not everyone can support. But if you want to, you get that early stuff. I put out a live stream for the patrons, and then roughly about a week or so later, this goes out to the public. But yeah, the lowest level to get that early stuff is $2. The highest level is my sponsors. I read them off every episode. And that's Toad, who's my co-host on Tower Gang. Then I have at Abrogate D's. Then Kevin B. Clark, a full-time guitarist and private music teacher in the New York area. Then at Zoveerack. Then at _ infinite zeal. Then Jacob Daniel of the Biblical Anarchy podcast at Biblical Anarchy. I think he's having Dave Smith on here soon for people who want to check that out, talking about borders or something like that. I mean, by the time this comes out for the public, that'll already be out. So definitely go. Actually, I don't know if it will be out because I think he paywalls his stuff too. So. Maybe go pay him too, you know. Then I also have Tim Tuttle at Jolly on Klebold. He's the one responsible for that edit you guys just saw. Then I have at Stinky Sock 420, singer of the band Bender, which is like a metalcore band, which if you like that intro, I would assume you would probably like this type of stuff. So definitely go check that out. I also have my, I guess we'll call him, I need to come up with a term for it, I guess corporate sponsor, who at the $5 or an up level, you guys get a chance for a raffle for coffee, but that's about to end here soon. So, hey, I mean, if he re-ups, then we'll probably do it again next month. So we'll see what goes on with that. But I do want to let you guys know about them. It's www.foxandsons.com. Fans of No Way Jose, use code Jose to receive 15% off your order of 30 or more. Orders of $37.99 and over always ship free. This is only in the continental U.S. Now these guys, these aren't just an advertiser. They're supporters. They support a lot of people who do stuff like I do. Help us out, you know, help us spread the message, help us do what we do. You know, like with letting people know about, you know, Yiki or stuff like that, or like the Jonestown, or heck, you guys know with all the 764 stuff going on, which I'm probably gonna have to do another one of those here soon. But yeah, he's a guy, he supports us. He supports these guys, us do this, it makes it so we're able to do this sort of stuff. He started this out of his love for coffee in a way to honor his times that he had with his dad. And then he took that and he passed it on to his kids to pass on the lessons he learned from his dad about entrepreneurship. And so that they can have a business as well, so he can pass on to them. High quality stuff, fresh, sourced from small family farms. I mean, I'm not kidding, it's good stuff. I normally put a little cream in my coffee. I've been drinking this stuff black just because it's so good. I'm not saying it's like weak either. It's still dark stuff. I like dark coffee. Yeah, the stuff comes quick, so get in on that. If you want to keep helping me out, you know, help him out. You know, he supports us, so you know, definitely go on over there, guys. And with that, let's get my buddy Austin in here, and we'll get into it. What's up, my friend? How you doing?
Good, brother. How you doing, man?
Good. Ready to get into it. I thought last episode was going to be the last one, and we still have more. Heck, I'm fine if we have another one. We'll do 10 of these if we need to. I don't care. We'll keep on keeping on. But I think last we talked, we're kind of getting to loose ends, and we're kind of also going to, you know, talk about maybe how this ties into COINTELPRO. I know last we talked, we were talking about this shady fella named Dan Mitrione. So, you know, wherever you want to take it, bud, and we'll get into it.
Awesome, brother. All right. So I thought a good starting point would be to give one quick example of like the religious beliefs that they the People's Temple began to embrace a lot more toward the end, and it seemed a lot less based in any sort of religious belief system and a lot more based in their belief in Jim Jones, right? And I mean even honestly, they seem to believe more in Marxism and you know, Leninist communism ideals than they did in even the religious tenets that they upheld, in my opinion. And here's one of from one of Jim's sermons. He says this. He says, and he, clearly his grammar is not very like he. It's kind of interesting how he grew more. He kind of implemented more and more of this inflection in his voice over time. And some of the tapes, some of the Jonestown tapes you listen to, they almost sound like different people, but you know, that's neither here nor there. But so during one of his sermons, though, he says, "Does your churches have any love? Does your preacher talk about the sky God? Will he give you a ride? Will he give you any buses? Has he given you any of those homes? Has he given you help? Does he go into the court and the jails and set you free? Does his sky Jesus do you any good? No, I'm the only one that'll help you. I'm the only one that cares about you. I'm the only one that loves you." I just thought, okay, well, interesting religion there, People's Temple. You know what I'm saying? Like, in a lot of his sermons, he would say things like this quite often. And even in the death tape, you hear him say, and this is after, you know, the members of the Red Brigade had gone out to commit the executions at Port Cayuma Airstrip. And right as he's getting the word back, you know, from that Congressman Leo Ryan and these individuals at Port Cayuma, you know, had been executed, he just switches on a dime and says, "I'm no longer coming to you as a man. I come to you as a prophet." And he just starts convincing everyone with much more pressure and angst in his voice. It was very interesting how quickly it changed as soon as he found out that Leo Ryan was dead, and then mentioned Dwyer to get him on down to the East House. But, and so according to transmissions from Jonestown, all right, some of the survivors went back to Jonestown and put, I guess they put tags on the toes of some of the bodies to identify them. And there were allegedly 33 survivors from the actual compound, right? And the Army, once in custody, as far as the, once the United States military took custody of the bodies, they just threw away all the tags, all the ID tags, and filed away over like almost half of the bodies as unidentified, right? And so these were allegedly children given to People's Temple by the California Social Services and patients from mental hospitals and rest homes. And if you remember, Jim Jones and the People's Temple effectively controlled the entire Mendocino County Welfare Department, which is interestingly enough, in the same area as Fort Bragg, which I just thought was interesting. And fingers were even removed from like many of the bodies in what was claimed to be an attempt to make identifications, but in effect stripped the dead of their last identifying features.
So they cut the fingers off?
Cut their fingertips off.
Oh.
Okay. And remember, so once the United States military arrived, remember they had originally signed off on the original count, which was only 400 some odd bodies. They had also routinely gone around to each of the bodies and stabbed them, and allegedly to let out these toxic gases that have built up while the bodies were out in the sun. But yeah, a lot of people.
So real quick, the claim was that they cut off the fingers got removed. Mm-hmm. In order to be able to more easily identify them was the argument. The argument was that I'm assuming they probably made some sort of argument that they were then going to check the fingers, but I don't know if they then lost them or something. Is that the idea?
No, they basically, that was the idea, that they were going to make identifications based on these fingertips that were then never
They were lost or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So none of those bodies were ever identified.
Which even, right? Even if we were to accept that, that would be a bizarre mm-hmm. way to go about it.
Very bizarre.
I mean, I guess you could make some sort of weird argument that, oh, this way we can leave the crime scene undisturbed and leave
right.
the bodies as they are. Just take a fingertip and go bring it to the lab and, oh, God, right. the fingers are gone.
Right. But medical authorities even claimed, like, just a simple fluid sample was never even taken on site. Right. Like, especially by the U.S. military. So, yeah, I mean, they basically, and I believe those same authorities claimed they did all of it backwards, you know. And then the main military official who came out and addressed this said that the cause of death was of no concern. Right. And so, like, look at all the cyanide everywhere. Like, clearly they all died of cyanide, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, there was something about the victims in Jonestown that the U.S. or maybe, you know, I think many of the officials of the Guyanese government at the time who were obviously being paid off, they didn't want the public to see that. And so this, I thought, was crazy because throughout the history of People's Temple, Jim Jones often received psychological treatment at sanitariums. And throughout the 60s and 70s, he was treated at the Langley Porter Neuropsychiatric Institute in San Francisco, that same one that I mentioned before.
The Langley,
huh? Yeah, yeah, I know, right? What does that make you think of? So his medical files are still sealed, but a witness stated in 1967 that Jones was treated for manic depression and was was apparently a documented sociopath. And Dr. Margaret Singer, who was a world-renowned clinical psychologist, anti-cult activist, and brainwashing expert, received funding through the Langley Institute. She was also a member of the American Family Foundation, along with Rabbi Maurice Davis, who sold Jim Jones his first church in Indiana. I thought that was insane, man. And apparently this guy also has connections.
Wait, is this Margaret Sanger or Margaret Singer?
No, not Margaret Sanger. Oh, that, not my, the no not way. The Planned Parenthood lady. No, that would be crazy, but no. This is too similar, but it's Margaret Singer. And okay. She's like a world-renowned clinical psychologist and an anti-cult activist, which I thought was even funnier. Well, not
sounds
funny.
A lot
but...
like Jolly West.
Yeah, dude. That's what I'm saying, man. It looks like everybody, on the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, the scientific advisory board. That's what it looks like. But she was also a member of the American Family Foundation, along with Rabbi Maurice Davis, who sold Jim Jones his first church in Indiana. And he's later, I forget what, either he was a member of the Carter administration, or he was just affiliated as some outside, like, yeah, institution involved with this anti-cult, and he's the guy that sold his first church to Jim Jones, right? So I just thought, what a unique set of circumstances to provide Jim Jones with his first, you know, brick and mortar church. That's crazy. And we know about his connections to the Carters later with Rosalind Carter and all of that. So, you know, that definitely, my eyebrow was raised instantly. But so the Defense Department funded a program at Langley that experimented with behavioral modification using electromagnetic fields and long distance hypnosis. And the military wanted to use extremely low frequency radiation for the purposes of mind control. Theoretically, the human brain cannot tell the difference between extremely low frequency radiation and its own brain waves. The frequency could be used to kill or shut off the brains of thousands of people within a small radius. So ironically, after the 33 survivors of Jonestown returned to the Bay Area, they were all treated at the insistence of Mayor George Moscone at the Langley Porter Neuropsychiatric Institute.
This is where you get into the crazy shit, where you get into like ELF, like waves and stuff. Dude, so this was totally, all that. Yeah. This is around the time where I think this is when they were, I mean, I think they were like in a decade or two prior as well, looking at this sort of technology, but I would assume this is roughly around the time where it was like peak when they were looking into it. So this would totally be, you know, theoretically, I'm not saying this is what they did, but this would be kind of a perfect testing ground, a ton of people to kind of test all these different technologies on to see how they work, because, you know, you kind of need an unsuspecting group and to see, you know, man. I don't know. Which, I mean, that it's stuff, so
crazy.
That stuff's so schizophrenic when you get into ELF stuff, when you're like, this is where you get into like shooters hearing voices or frequencies, or you're like, what the fuck is going on?
That's what was going on with when I was doing this James Holmes episode, man. I was like, where am I? Like, this is crazy, man. The fact that, you know, what Stephen Unruh said about him was phenomenal, but it was beyond that. I mean, the idea that he was in this dissociative state in his programming until what he was like described as by witnesses as like robotic, you know, robotically shooting into the crowd, that basically he just stopped on a dime, turned and casually walked back out to his car, where he stood until he was apprehended by the police, who said that he was like in this weird trance-like state. And meanwhile, he's telling people in court that he believed he was being followed and surveilled by the FBI, and that the FBI would stop him before he could carry out his mission, and that he waited, could have been even 10 minutes at the door before re-entering Theater 9 and going through with his mission, which is what he continues to call it. It's very interesting. But yeah, what Stephen Unruh says in NLP and neuro-linguistic programming, the temporal illusions that he's studying with the Salk Institute, that, you know, what was that soldier program that they were, I mentioned last time. I can't remember. Anyway, it's just that it's absurd, brother. You know what I mean? Like with DARPA, the, I digress. So, but I'm just saying, like, you really start to question what has and what is and what will be possible with, it seems like there is legitimate science in regard to effectively controlling these electromagnetic frequencies, these different radio waves, you know, it's very possible, I think, and at least to trigger dissociative states with through drugs, through many different methods that they've perfected, it seems. And I think Jonestown was a part of that, right?
Yeah, I would say that the silver lining here is it seems like, in my opinion, I might be wrong, but just from like my dives into these weird parapolitics world, it seems like whatever methods they've developed, that it doesn't seem like they can just take any old Joe and just be like, we're going to fucking throw some ELF waves at him and make him go kill some people. Maybe they can. Maybe they can. I don't know. But it seems more like, it always seems that these people, whether it's like Chapman and like Lennon, or whether it's Sirhan or what, any of these people, or
even Jack Ruby, man. I mean, remember when Jack Ruby got tackled?
Put in time, you know what I mean? Like, they had to prime them. Like,
I agree. Like,
they had to have some sort of psychologist, something. And maybe that's just a matter of that they're just really trying to get it perfect. And so maybe they really could just hit one person and not really prime them at all and go through all these things. I would say, because it does make people like maybe schizophrenic and be like, when I hear like a, say you hear a low electrical whine somewhere, like, am I being fucked with right now?
Oh,
you
my know? God, man. No shit, dude. And by the way, it was the Peak Soldier Performance Program was the name of that program that he, as a research intern at the Salk Institute, you know, for research on neuroscience. I mean, and he was literally working with DARPA at that time on the Peak Soldier Performance Program, where they were doing these these temporal illusion studies and all these different things. And he had to like present this entire, I forgot what it was called, but it was very, very interesting, man. And it, exactly in the realm of what happened to him at Theater 9 at Century 16 Movie Theater in Aurora, Colorado. It's just ridiculous, man. And Dr. Lynn Fenton, you know, was the psychiatrist at the facility. And I don't believe her for a second. I mean, she basically was just protecting herself in trial. And the whole notion that they got that personal journal of James Holmes, who allegedly chose to send it to her at that neuroscience research institute, which was a military institute, send it to her, who he then later, by the way, tells Stephen Unruh that, you know, programmed him to kill. But yeah, man, it is crazy. So, but anyway, I think that when you like, and through my research into all of that, I found this crazy book about these two sisters who allegedly they wrote this book called, well, their story is what I'm saying is, I'm not entirely certain if every aspect of it is true, but man, it was a compelling story. And they titled their book Secret Weapons, How Two Sisters Were Brainwashed to Kill for Their Country. And one of the sisters' names is Lynn Hersha. And I put this in my last episode because I thought, this is just, man, like, could you imagine? Because when I heard Stephen Unruh, that alleged, you know, fellow inmate with James Holmes who allegedly talked to him, when I heard him describe that James was basically freaking out when he first was brought in to custody with a hood over his head and put into an isolated cell and was like smashing his fists on the wall and then running as fast as he could and smashing his head and body against the wall. And Unruh's like, dude, stop doing that, man. But all that I thought was, what if, right? Like, what if his own brain is not responsible for what happened, right? Like, what if, you know what I mean? I was just really considering those things. And like, could you imagine what you felt if you just were told what you did, right? Mm-hmm. And allegedly, he wanted Unruh to write up this apology letter about what he had done to the children. So I just thought that was interesting. And I just thought, man, like, what would I do? You know? Like, man, would I want to try and run through that wall as hard as I can and kill myself? Just, I don't even know. Like, what would I do? You know? And so anyway, but that sister, Lynn Hersha, man, she said in this book, she said, what angers me is the loss of control. At any moment, someone could come to me, be dressed the right way, and use the right code, and I no longer have free will. I will do anything that person requests. I hate them for that. Nothing else is as bad as knowing that I am always out of control. Knowing that I am still a laboratory experiment, a puppet whose strings are hidden from everyone but my handlers, and I don't yet know how to break free.
Yep, woman in the polka dot dress is what that makes me think of. Dude,
Elaine Neal. First thing in my mind was that. Like, was 100% Sirhan. And man, his story too, man. I don't want to get off on that, but
yeah. Sorry, I have a whole series for those.
Yeah, my bad.
Piece, so.
That's funny. So anyway, beyond that crazy connection to who sold him his first church, Jim Jones, like I was mentioning, basically the very institution responsible for the mental health of Jim Jones now treated the survivors of his descent into madness, right? Which I just found crazy and absolutely ridiculous, because this was the same institution, psychiatric facility, that not only Jim Jones had been frequenting for himself before all of this, but he was taking members of People's Temple members to, you know, for some alleged rehabilitation program. So Anyway, my opinion is Jim Jones was a CIA asset, at the very least, who told his neighbors while he was in Brazil in the early 1960s. And this was when he was supposedly scouting locations for the church. This is what he told his neighbors. He said that he was employed by the Office of Naval Intelligence. And during his time in Rio de Janeiro, working for an alleged CIA front company called Invesco, his landlady referred to him as a gangster who used the Bible instead of a gun. And it's a well-established fact that he had a childhood friend who just so happened to be the local police chief at the time by the name of Dan Mitrione. Mitrione allegedly kept Jones from being arrested or run out of town and was recruited into the CIA under State Department cover, later entering the International Police Academy, which was a known CIA front used to outsource counterinsurgency training and torture techniques. So coincidentally, Mitrione had traveled to Brazil as an OPS advisor at the U.S. consulate not long before Jones had arrived. And this is when a CIA 201 file was opened on Jim Jones at about that time. So in 1961, when Jones suddenly had the money for a trip to minister in Belo Horizonte, site of the CIA headquarters in Brazil, it was CIA handler Dan Mitrione who would meet him there while rising through the ranks of the CIA-funded International Police Academy, responsible for training foreign police in assassination and torture methods. After an 8-month stay in Belo Horizonte, Jim Jones would move on to Rio de Janeiro, where he happened to cross paths yet again with the alleged MKUltra outsourcer Dan Mitrione, who would later be kidnapped by guerrilla groups in Uruguay in 1970, only to be subsequently interrogated and murdered. And they tried to use him as a hostage and get something in return, and I guess that didn't work out. But anyway,
way for a guy who's I think he was known, if I recall correctly, mostly for torture, which kind of ties perfectly into MK Ultra type stuff. Yeah. So
it's basically where they,
that's how he went out.
Isn't it? Especially when basically turned into the enhanced interrogation techniques that were then embraced during Abu Ghraib and all that shit in the Iraq war.
Yeah, so. I really wonder if I don't know what specific group captured him, but I wonder if they were using his methods, because I actually have a couple CIA manuals over here that I bought that were declassified that go, and I need to read them at some point where they go into their torture methods. And they were made because I believe they were actually distributing them to South American countries. So yeah, he may have played, I wouldn't be surprised if he played a part in kind of formalizing this these tactics. And 100%. I mean, let's be real, these get passed around and these end up with whatever, I don't know what group he was abducted by, but I wouldn't be surprised if they somehow got around, because I mean, they a lot of times they'll train these guerrilla groups and in these techniques, and they don't always work out the way they want them to. So
exactly, man.
Look at like the Taliban and shit like that. So watch, probably in like 10 years we'll be dealing with the 8th battalion or something. So.
Probably, man. Honestly. Yeah. So in February of 1960, this is even crazier, man, because this, I didn't know about this until fairly recently. I didn't realize there was allegedly there's a rumor that he had visited Cuba. And so I looked into this, and it turns out there's like some legitimate threads you can tug on that seem to show that he even had a picture personally with him and his wife Marceline with Fidel Castro, man. And so in February 1960, he had decided to visit Havana, Cuba, just after Fidel Castro's overthrow of the Batista regime. And subsequent claims would later surface suggesting that Jones may have been spying on Cuba for the CIA using his evangelism as a cover. And it seems that even before he was 30 years old, he was trying to establish a communal system of living that ran like an old slave plantation. And in 79, in the wake of post-Jonestown massacre press frenzy, a man named Carlos Foster came forward claiming that he had met Jim Jones at the Havana Hilton in the winter of 1960. So there, Jones allegedly explained his plan to help 40 Cuban families resettle in America and promised Carlos $50,000 a year if he could also help him establish subsistence settlements throughout South America. Author Tim Reiterman, he writes that Jones left for Hawaii by himself in late October of 1961, later sent for his family. When Jim arrived in Brazil in 62, he carried a photograph of himself and his wife Marceline posing with the Cuban premier. Jones said that the picture was taken on a stopover in Cuba on the way to Sao Paulo. Reportedly, Cuba wasn't the only country to which Jones intended to travel, though, in early 1960. And on June 28th of that same year, the State Department issued a passport to Jones in the city of Chicago for a 17-day visit to Poland, Finland, the USSR, and England. The purpose of the trip, according to Jones' visa application, was sightseeing culture. Suspiciously, the first passport was still valid when another passport was issued to him on January 20th, 1962, from the city of Indianapolis during the same 6 months he was allegedly in Guyana prior to his trip to Belo Horizonte, Brazil, which instantly made me think of Lee Harvey Oswald, Marion David Petty, and Mark David Chapman, right? Because the passport story is always the same, right? And by the way, you remember when I forgot that I had just mentioned Jack Ruby. And when Jack Ruby was tackled to the ground after firing the shots into Oswald, apparently he says, "I'm Jack Ruby. What are you doing? Why are you doing this to me? Where am I?" Like that type of shit, right? Like he was completely in a dissociative state, in a trance-like state. And then later when Dr. Louis Jolyon West visits him and right before he's supposed to give his or testify, he loses his damn mind, has a psychological break he can never return from, and starts running his mouth about Jews being burned alive outside his cell, you know? Like, and that was not even very long as far as the meeting with West with Ruby before he had this psychological break he would never return from. But how is this not the playbook, man? I mean, this is ridiculous. It seems like Jonestown, for me, Jonestown has become basically the best example, the most clear example of when MKUltra was driven underground, when MKUltra was embraced by the cults. Now, I think that it already had been happening before this. I think that Charles Manson was a huge product of MKUltra. I think that, you know, later on, Luke Jarret and the Order of the Solar Temple and in Belgium, Congo. I mean, that has all the hallmarks of Jonestown. I mean, it looks like Jonestown.
I think to some extent, in a certain sense, not in an overt fashion, even the 7-6-4 shit, the stuff that I've been covering sort of does as well. I mean, I don't think it's like super overt. I feel like it's more of like a runaway type thing to where like their concept got away from them. And I don't feel like they're having control over it. I think it's more just the concept ran away and went wild. But yeah, I do think this is kind of like you can follow these breadcrumbs from one thing to another. So, but yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say like that's like 100% like some sort of Fed ops. I don't want to give anyone that impression. I think these guys are like, but I think, you know, that's kind of like if you look at like a modern form of it, and especially like they've kind of gone more decentralized and these things kind of, these concepts have kind of taken on a life of their own and kind of traveled from one thing to another and no longer really getting as much control. Although I think, especially if you look at the 09A stuff, there might be. I mean, it's really 09A gets, because you have 7-6-4 and it's supposedly an offshoot of the 09A. I do think there might be something to that. It's really hard to kind of see beyond the veil of what the fuck is going on with 09A. But I mean, if you look at some of the individuals involved and you're like, okay. And then I think the idea becomes, you know, I mean, anybody who's like a big constitutionalist will know the idea of like a 3%er. It's like, You know, how much influence do you really need to have within an organization to be able to sway it one way or another, or to, you know, move it to your will, especially if you kind of have a concept that you've kind of, that's been allowed to percolate, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they basically, inherently are kind of, it seems like a preordained outcome, right? Like it's going to happen. It's almost inevitable, right? It's like, it's basically it's almost fits just perfectly with what Bo Gritz says about Jonestown, right? Where it's like, it's not good in its essence, right? Like, no matter what you think about Bo Gritz, I do appreciate what he says about Jonestown, because I do think they utilized as far as the growing body count, I think that this operation blew up in their face. I think they basically orchestrated the end of it because they needed, you know, a way to conveniently get rid of some of the bodies that were involved in a lot of these other MK Ultra sub projects that they had going on at the exact same time. And so I take Bo Gritz at his word a little bit when it comes to, they could have just as easily been bringing people down from the Montreal experiments who had nobody, you know, to vouch for them, nobody to care for them, nobody to concerned about their well-being. And, you know, we need to tie off loose ends, right? MK Ultra ends in the minds of the public, especially the American public in Guyana, right? Like, that's kind of how it feels to me. Like, and when they lured Leo Ryan down there, it seemed to me like, here's our opportunity to get rid of this thorn in our side that's attempting to basically get rid of black budget operations in the U.S. and severely crack down on the intelligence community. And they weren't going to let that happen, right? So, like, I think, anyway, I won't just speculate. But, yeah, I find it very interesting. You know, it's such an absurd story, man. Jonestown's one of the most extraordinary things I've ever read about in my life, right? Like, and it really is one of the most compelling stories in regard to just what the CIA is capable of, right? Like, my God, you know? So anyway, Richard Dwyer and his CIA background, he came into much controversy over the fact that he had been appointed to protect Congressman Leo Ryan and his party on their fact-finding mission while serving as a liaison considered the deputy chief of mission at the American Embassy in Georgetown. And he also happened to be the American Embassy official who accompanied Leo Ryan to Jonestown on the weekend of November 17th, even allegedly returning to Jonestown from the Port Kaiuma airstrip after the attack that killed the congressman and four others. And by the way, one of the reasons that the two transport planes were, I guess, delayed at Port Kaiuma airstrip before all of this could happen, giving them the window of time they needed for the tractor-drawn trailer to come down there with the Red Brigade and the supposed, you know, robotic machine-like, assassins that, you know, that went through executing individuals. And I believe Congressman Leo Ryan was, they triple tapped him to the head and he had well over 20 bullets that entered his body. So, but allegedly Dwyer had separated from, so he had, if you remember when Ujara tried to attack Congressman Leo Ryan after he had been given the note that said, please help us get out of Jonestown. Somebody passed, like, covertly passed Congressman Leo Ryan the note. And after that happened, Ujara, Don Sly, right, one of the members of the Red Brigade that was an allegedly a CIA informant who brought members of the Red Brigade to Jonestown and People's Temple, that Dwyer was the one who convinced Leo Ryan, we got to get out of here, right? We got to go back to the airstrip. You know, you can come back if you want and try and orchestrate later, like, some of these people to get out of here and deal with some of these concerned relatives who were there as well. And so And I guess there were some family disputes happening because some people wanted to leave, others didn't want to leave, you know, so things like that were happening. And so I found it interesting that Dwyer was the one to convince Leo Ryan to leave. And then as he convinces them to leave, he leaves with them, but then separates with them halfway to the airstrip, allegedly going to get what the hell's the name of the embassy? If they're not, they're like local police guard, basically, he was going to acquire in order to help protect them. Was I forget the damn term for him. But anyway, so he had broken away from the group in order to do this, and this is partly why they were delayed at the airstrip, giving them perfect amount of time that they needed to have the control that they needed to commit this execution style hit at Port Kaiuma on Leo Ryan and some of the concerned relatives and some of the journalists as well. If you remember, he had like four journalists with him. But I did find that interesting because I'm not sure if Dwyer ever went back to the airstrip or if he just went back to Jonestown and he didn't intend on getting any type of protection or security for, you know, the Leo Ryan's group, or if, because like I said, he's the one who convinced him to leave. And so it kind of seems like he sets the stage for, here's our window of opportunity. And so that's the only reason I felt like I should mention that. And and remember, Dwyer returned to the massacre. We know this because Jim Jones himself can be heard in the final death tape mentioning Dwyer, right? Get Dwyer out of here. Take him down to the East House. And Richard Dwyer was, now we know, all right? He was a CIA agent who happened to be identified in the 1968 edition of Who's Who in the CIA. Even longtime member of the People's Temple, Caroline Layton, wrote a letter to her parents alluding to the assumption by the Temple's leadership that whenever they were talking to Dwyer, Burke, McCoy, or any of a number of others, they were talking with the CIA and gauged their comments accordingly. And Jim Hogan, his work can be found in the archives as well at SDSU. He lends credibility to this in regard to Dwyer's background with the CIA. And he reported that Dwyer's background is that of a sheep-dipped CIA officer whose State Department cover had long ago worn thin. After graduating from Princeton in 1957, he'd gone to work at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research until February 1959. In the years that followed, he was posted to Damascus from 60 to 63, Cairo from 63 to 66, Washington from 66 to 68, Sofia, Bulgaria from 70 to 72. And then after returning home in 72, he was subsequently shifted to Chad until in 1977, he was brought home again to become part of the State Department's Inspection Corps. In that role, he traveled throughout much of Western South America, Bolivia, Peru, Chile, Ecuador. And then finally on April 14th, 1978, he arrived in Georgetown, Guyana to take up his responsibilities as deputy chief of mission. So that guy is no doubt 100% CIA connected. And that Dwyer was a deep cover CIA officer is apparent. Dr. Julius Madar, an East German author with ties to the Stasi intelligence service, alleged as much in a book that he'd written 10 years prior to Jonestown, Who's Who in the CIA, right? Joseph Holsinger, Leo Ryan's best friend and chief of staff, echoes the charge, citing congressional sources. And the same allegation is made by the defense attorney for Larry Layton, and who was the one that was originally convicted for his role in the assassination of Congressman Ryan. And of course, the Justice Department attorneys representing Dwyer and the judge who presided over the Layton case refused to let Layton's defense attorney question Dwyer about his work for the CIA. And when he was officially asked about it, he refused to comment. So the information that a CIA agent or officer was at the scene of the Port Kaiuma ambush was then given to Joel Holsinger by a Washington colleague, whom whistleblower or who Holsinger regards, he claims, was an unimpeachable source. And despite the efforts of Layton's defense attorney, this evidence was not admitted in court. But, you know, nevertheless, it's pretty damn clear that a CIA man was present at both the ambush and the massacre.
And he's the one who kind of, he's the one, if I recall correctly, that sort of kind of pushed Leo Ryan to come down here in the first place, then was sort of helping him out a lot of the way. Just to reiterate this for the audience, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, and then obviously then kind of, you know, convinces him to leave, but mm-hmm. then ends up going back, you know, right. seemingly was may or may not have been a part of the hit squad on Leo mm-hmm. Ryan, and then somehow gets back for the actual, you know, White Knight or whatever. So, yep. I mean, you know, whether fishy.
And just, people believe yeah. that at least there are a lot of theories and there are many rumors, but I've read a lot of different reports that claim that covert channel, the radio frequency that reported the initial massacre. I'm talking at like 3 a.m. in the morning, like before GDF. None of the Guyanese Defense Forces were ever there at this point. Nobody could have known. But on this covert CIA channel that first reported the massacre, the theory is that that was Richard Dwyer after he terminated Jim Jones, right? And that he was reporting in, mission accomplished, right? And that that's the reason that they already had all those body bags ready to go, like what's his name, L. Fletcher Prouty had mentioned, that I talked about last episode, I believe it was, and that he was basically saying that that was the reason that they had all those body bags ready to go. But the Joint Chiefs of Staff were fully prepared for this, and they knew before even the locals knew. So that's pretty nuts. But they do claim that it was Dwyer himself that is the one who terminated Jones and then first reported it to the CIA on this covert CIA channel. So, you know, that would kind of corroborate what we're saying as far as how much control as an operator Richard Dwyer actually had at Jonestown. It could, you know, at least make you stop to think, right? So, like, beyond the fact that he was clearly on the death tape and that he was obviously in at both Port Kaiuma airstrip and at the massacre, and identified by members of People's Temple who claimed that he was CIA and that they were aware of it. I mean, then we get his background showing where the hell he was stationed for, you know, in the years that he was stationed in these areas. And so to me, it just seems like you can't even debate the fact that he had a clear role in what happened at Jonestown and made it out alive. Right, is one of the only people who survived, and conveniently all the CIA, you know, contacts and assets in Jonestown, other than Jim himself, allegedly, they survived as well, you know, and yeah. and some of the attorneys, is including Charles Gari and Mark Lane, who, if you remember, William Holsinger, Congressman Leo Ryan's aide and best friend, he says he despises Mark Lane. And that he views his book as basically a pack of lies, although he does say there are certain truths that, you know, he mined throughout it and used as an example when he was giving that speech. But so I think that we, you know, like if we're going to, like, clearly they weren't even going to let this be, this question be asked in court during Larry Layton's trial. And so, I mean, Mark Lane is the other person besides Richard Dwyer that I think helped. Well, I would say Deborah Layton Blakey, she helped as well, like lure Congressman Leo Ryan down there. Because if it weren't for the Concerned Relatives Committee, he probably wouldn't have come in the first place. But it was the affidavit put forward by Deborah Layton Blakey, who we now know was affiliated with you know, Larry Layton was her brother, who was the one who was, you know, tried and actually had to do time for conspiring to kill Congressman Leo Ryan. Her husband was George Philip Blakey, who was the guy who leased the land for working with the CIA, right? With Unitas. And so we'll get to that right before we end this. We'll get to that because I have to at least say that much, because it's absolutely ridiculous how many aspects of the Layton family are involved at Jonestown and who their father was, right? And his relationship to Jonestown, which I've mentioned before, but it's even worse than we thought. And it seems like he was a part of, maybe it was, and Alex Constantine even says as much, as that it was more Lawrence Layton's project than it was Jim Jones, I think he even says, which I found very interesting. But, and by the way, there were like murders from all these people, Temple's members, right after the fact, after the massacre. And one of the, I say the most famous one is Al and Jeannie Mills, right? And it turns out that they had to even change their names, one, to avoid the legal control that Jim Jones had over their lives, right? And so this is what the story is with them, right? They were originally known as Elmer and Deanne Myrtle, not Alan Jeannie Mills. And they joined the People's Temple in 1969 and eventually rose to positions of responsibility within the church. And Deanna, she served as head of the temple's publications office, and Elmer as the official photographer. In 74, the Mills took their family and left the church after Jones beat their daughter, Linda, 70 times with a wooden paddle for allegedly having a friend who Jim suspected as a traitor, that he betrayed the church. The family legally changed their names to void the power of attorney they had earlier given Jones, and soon became two of its most vocal critics. They founded the Human Freedom Center as a refuge for other temple defectors and were active in the Concerned Relatives organization, which was founded to focus media, political, and government pressure on Jim Jones. Because of their defections and their high-profile campaigns against him, Jones often lashed out at the Mills, calling them traitors and threatening like retribution against them. And you can even hear Jim say on the death tape, "Remember Deanna and Elmer Myrtle? The people in San Francisco will not take our death in vain." And while they seem to have eventually yielded their leadership role in the campaign against Jim to Tim Stone, who was the one who had that custody battle about his son, Tim and Grace were the ones who were trying to sue Jim in order to gain custody of their son again. But their names no longer appeared, as far as the Mills. Their names no longer appeared on the April 78 accusation of human rights violations prepared by the Concerned Relatives. But earlier on, they were among the first to come forward to speak to Phil Tracy and Marshall Kilduff, who were the journalists who ran the Inside People's Temple August 1977 article in the New West magazine, which the Chronicle and the Examiner both passed on because they were affiliated with Jim and they were doing him a favor. And so after they sold it to the New West magazine, these are the journalists who contacted the Concerned Relatives group. And I guess these Mills, Jeannie and Ann, or and Al Mills, they were the sources of the allegation that Jonestown was stockpiling illegal weapons, which prompted an investigation by the U.S. Customs Service. And they were instrumental in hiring the private investigator who went to Jonestown as well on at least two occasions to try and retrieve Jonestown residents. But like I think I said this before, that I guess the allegiance of this private detective was later questioned for some reason. Not entirely sure. I haven't nailed down the details on that, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know, because it seemed like they had a lot of control over who could come in and out of Georgetown, and especially who could actually go to the Jonestown compound. So they also spoke with Leo Ryan, and his aide Jackie Speier in the weeks leading up to Congressman Leo Ryan's trip to Jonestown. And in the immediate aftermath of the deaths in Jonestown, the Human Freedom Center offered itself as the stateside contact for survivors who had no place else to go. Both of the Mills made themselves available for interviews with the FBI, and Jeannie Mills especially resumed her activism in the 15 months following Jonestown. She spoke before numerous college classes and public meetings, and she even wrote a book that was like a memoir, and it was called 6 Years with God, Life Inside Reverend Jim Jones People's Temple. And she says after the killings, the Mills family initially, I guess they hold up with other defectors in protective custody of a police SWAT team, and eventually decided to resume normal life. But according to an article published in People magazine in March 1980, when they cooperated with the New West magazine to expose, cooperated with New West magazine in its expose that helped drive Jones to Guyana. That was really when he left, was when he was tipped off that this magazine was going to publish. And so she said this after she cooperated with them in that article. She said, it was like signing our own death warrant. That's what she says. And then police protection after the massacre came as a welcome relief from fear, according to the Mills. And she says, that was the first time I felt no one could kill us. I just thought that was very revealing. They were clearly in fear for their lives, like after leaving the People's Temple, and they left in Ukiah. So, you know, it's just crazy to me that only 15 months after the Jonestown massacre, and clearly she was doing a lot of work trying to smear his name. Both Al and Jeannie were. And it was only 15 months after the massacre happened when on February 26, 1980, it was Al and Jeannie Mills and their 16-year-old daughter, Daphne, that were murdered execution style inside their home in Berkeley, California. There was no sign of forced entry, and burglary was quickly ruled out as a motive. Their murders raised the fear of these temple hit squads, right? And so the rumors dissipated when the police turned their attention to 17-year-old Eddie Mills, who was the son in the house at the time of the shootings, but was left unharmed. Now, Eddie claimed he was unaware that the killings had taken place, even though police found gunshot residue on his hands. Yes. So I just, like, in my mind, I just think, like, the story is probably entirely different than this, but my first thought was the sleeper assassins that Jackie Speier claimed were, you know, there were a lot of in Jonestown, which carried out the executions of the Port Cayuma airstrip, which to me meant, well, it's possible. And I know now that Eddie Mills lived for a time at Jonestown. Right. And so it's very possible that Eddie Mills had some programmed, you know, code that could be triggered at any time. And Eddie would wake up and have his own white knight and not remember anything and maybe have the best sleep of his life and then wake up with gunshot residue on his hands and no memory of the crime. And clearly, I know that's speculation, but after the fact that he was the one who was the official suspect from day one and then later on acquitted from some technicality. And then later in 2005, they actually arrest him again, which I found interesting. So, and by the way, it was suggested by Michael Myers, who's this author who he wrote this awesome book on Jonestown. And he suggests that Jeannie and her family were executed by the CIA along with George Moscone, Harvey Milk, and a number of other former associates of Jim Jones due to their knowledge of Jones' relationship with the CIA. This contention is supported by the purchase of the rights to Jeannie Mills' book, 6 Years with God, by an obscure, newly formed publishing company that took it out of print almost immediately and then simply ceased to exist. It's a little strange, you know what I mean? And so the initial investigation was shelved until 2005 when police re-interviewed several surviving members of the Mills family. And there was no new evidence to overturn anything in the case. So it was very unusual that they renewed this cold case after all these years. And so since apparently no new evidence was uncovered and no new forensics technology could assist in any reviewing existing, like as far as the existing evidence, Eddie was then arrested in San Francisco at the airport upon his return to the U.S. for the first time in several years, because I guess he moved to Japan. And he spent several days in the Redwood City Jail before being transferred to the East Bay. And on December 8th, the Alameda County District Attorney's Office declined to file charges, citing a lack of evidence, and Eddie was released. So to this day, the Mills murders remain unsolved. But what a crazy ass, at least like it's for me, at least a loose end was being tied off. I'm not entirely certain if it is Mike Myers was claiming, that author was claiming, that it was, you know, loose ends tied off by the CIA, which to me makes the most sense. But, you know, there were other theories, right?
It always seems to be any of these major events, there's so many people who drop dead. So many people.
100%, man.
Yeah.
So. But the fact that they played such a key role in, one, smearing Jim Jones publicly, right? And then two, triggering that publication of that article, which allegedly is the reason that he was ran out of Ukiah, you know? So it's just strange, right? And then especially when he mentions them personally on the death tape as if they're going to receive some sort of retribution. Plus you have the Mills claiming, you know, to be in fear for their life, like for quite a while. And even after the massacre, which I found interesting. But anyway, so Mark Lane has this absurd connection to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And it is really one of the strangest connections in this story, because it in 66, okay, consider the fact that Mark Lane was the first JFK investigator to debunk the Warren Commission in his book Rush to Judgment. Okay. And like Mark Lane is considered by many other people to be played a key role in exposing the FBI's relationship to the actual assassination of MLK Jr. And after learning more about Mark Lane, I side with William Holsinger. I don't believe a word that guy says. Like I think he is some operative in Mockingbird or something that we're unaware of, but I feel like there are key operatives in the media landscape that fall on all sides of the spectrum strategically. So of course they would use their own key operatives to break stories that might, you know, smear the name of the agency or whatever in order to gain, you know, legitimate support, you know, for their work. I mean, that would make a lot of sense to me, but who knows? I mean, again, speculation, but it's still, I don't trust this guy for a second. And so the fact that he has all these overlapping connections with like the most ridiculous conspiracies that ever happened in United States history is kind of ridiculous. But so in the late 1970s, he happened to represent Jim Jones in the People's Temple and would even be present at Jonestown in Guyana on November 18th. So the story goes that Mark Lane barely survived by fleeing into the jungle, only to publish a timely book the very next year exploiting the tragedy. Not only was Mark Lane present during the Jonestown massacre, he was also conveniently in charge of several key witnesses being questioned by the House Select Committee on Assassinations during this time. As a part of the open investigation into the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., one of the witnesses in his custody just so happened to be the wife of James Earl Ray's landlord, who owned the apartments where the shots were fired, responsible for killing MLK. John Judge, he wrote this seminal piece that's found in the Jonestown archives, and it's titled The Black Hole of Guyana. And it's one of my favorite things to read in all the archives. And he's the one, he really, it's a very long series, but he breaks down this, he's got this key section that he breaks down this connection, laying out this compelling evidence linking Jonestown to the murder of MLK. And he describes the first clue to this link appearing in the personal histories of the members of the Ryan investigation team who were so selectively and deliberately killed at Port Kaiuma. Don Harris, a veteran NBC reporter, had been the only network newsman on the scene to cover Martin Luther King's activity in Memphis at the time of King's assassination. He had interviewed key witnesses at the site. His coverage of the urban riots that followed won him an Emmy Award. Gregory Robinson, a fearless journalist from the San Francisco Examiner, had photographed the same riots in Washington, D.C. when he was approached for copies of the films by Justice Department officials, and he threw the negatives into the Potomac River. The role of Mark Lane, these are like the, it seems like Congressman Leo Ryan's entourage were the only people effectively, I mean, tracking down the breadcrumbs linking back to MK Ultra and the CIA and all the institutions that they were that were facilitating these projects. It really does, man. Like everything that I see, he was the white knight. He was here to save us all, man. I'm never going to put somebody on a pedestal like that, but man, he does seem kind of like a hero after all of this. But so beyond that, the role of Mark Lane, who served as attorney for Jim Jones, is even more clearly intertwined. Lane had co-authored a book with Dick Gregory claiming FBI complicity in the King murder. He was hired as the attorney for James Earl Ray, accused assassin, when Ray testified before the House Select Committee on Assassinations about King. Prior to this testimony, Ray was involved in an unusual escape plot at Brushy Mountain State Prison. The prisoner who had helped engineer the escape plot was later inexplicably offered an early parole by members of the Tennessee governor's office. These officials and Governor Blanton himself were to come under close public scrutiny and face legal charges in regard to bribes taken to arrange illegal early pardons for prisoners. So one of the people living at Jonestown was an ex-FBI agent named Wesley Swearingen, who at least publicly condemned the COINTELPRO operations and other abuses based on stolen classified documents at the Jonestown site. Lane had reportedly met with him there at least a year before the massacre. Terry Buford said the documents were passed on to Charles Gari, who, by the way, conveniently escaped the Jonestown carnage with Mark Lane, right? And Richard Dwyer, who claims to have been mildly injured during the massacre. So Lane used information from Swearingen in his thesis on the FBI and King's murder. And Swearingen later served as a key witness in suits against the Justice Department brought by the Socialist Workers Party. When Larry Flint, the flamboyant publisher of Hustler magazine, offered a $1 million reward leading to the capture and conviction of the John F. Kennedy killers, the long-distance number listed to collect information and leads was being answered by Mark Lane and Wesley Swearingen. So, with help from officials in Tennessee, Governor Blanton's office, Lane managed to get legal custody of a woman who had been incarcerated in the Tennessee state psychiatric system for nearly 8 years. This is the insane connection. This woman, her name is Grace Walden Stevens. She had been a witness in the King murder and was living at the time in Memphis in a rooming house across from the hotel when Martin Luther King was shot. The official version of events had Ray located in the common bathroom of the rooming house and claimed he used a rifle to murder King from that window. Grace Stevens did indeed see a man run from the bathroom, past her door, and down to the street below. A rifle, later linked circumstantially to James Earl Ray, was found inside a bundle at the base of the rooming house stairs, which I, every time I hear that story, I just think, oh, they found Oswald's gun. It was just so perfect. You know what I mean? And identified as the murder weapon very conveniently. But Grace, who saw the man clearly, refused to identify him as Ray when shown photographs by the FBI. Her testimony was never introduced at the trial. The FBI relied instead on the word of her common-law husband, Charles Stevens, who was drunk and unconscious at the time of the incident. Her persistence in saying that it was not James Earl Ray was used at her mental competency hearings as evidence against her, and she disappeared into the psychiatric system. Grace Walden Stevens. She later took up residence with Lane as her custodian, and Terry Buford, a key Temple member who had returned to the U.S. before the killings to live with Lane. While arranging for her to testify before the Select Committee on Ray's behalf, Lane and Buford were plotting another fate for Grace Stevens. Notes from Buford to Jones, found in the aftermath of the killings, discussed arrangements with Lane to move Grace Stevens to Jonestown. The problem that remained was lack of a passport. But Buford suggested either getting a passport on the black market or using the passport of former Temple member Maxine Swaney. Swaney, dead for nearly 2.5 years since her departure from the Ukiah camp, was in no position to argue, and Jones apparently kept her passport with him. So whether Grace ever arrived at Jonestown, that is unclear. However, she would never be able to testify on behalf of James Earl Ray due to her unusual disappearance while in the custody of Mark Lane. Only this time, no obituaries, no medical records. Grace Walden Stevens had officially vanished. I mean, that right there, man. Like, that is ridiculous, right? Like, absolutely ridiculous to me that there's actually connections that direct to potentially bringing a key witness in the MLK assassination to Jonestown under a fake identity and possibly, oh, I don't know, maybe dying there.
Just a under black hole for loose ends is what this place is.
Exactly. Under the fake narrative, the false narrative of a revolutionary mass suicide. You know, I mean, it's just absolute ridiculous narrative, man. I mean, I don't know how people can actually buy it without, unless you have looked into it, haven't looked into it at all, you know? So,
yeah.
But I mean, it's kind of crazy because this is the part where, I mentioned in last episode that, that someone was questioning the fact that Congressman Leo Ryan and his entourage that had visited Jonestown were actually eating the food there and that it could potentially have been drugged. And so Lane was forced to leave Ray in the midst of testimony to the Select Committee when he got word that Ryan was planning to visit. I thought that was kind of revealing, right? Why does Mark Lane have to rush back to Guyana when he finds out Congressman Leo Ryan's actually going to visit? And so Lane had attempted to discourage the trip earlier in a vaguely threatening letter. And now he rushed to be sure he arrived with the group. At the scene, he failed to warn Ryan and others, knowing that the sandwiches and other food might be drugged, but refrained from eating it himself. I found that very interesting and worth mentioning. But later, claiming that he and Charles Gari would write the official history of the revolutionary suicide, Lane was reportedly well aware of the forced drugging and suicide drills at Jonestown before Ryan arrived. And another important figure in the murder of Martin Luther King, of course, was his mother, Alberta. And a few weeks after the first public announcement by Coretta Scott King that she believed her husband's murder was part of a conspiracy, Mrs. Alberta King was brutally shot to death in Atlanta while attending church services. Anyone who had seen the physical wound suffered by King might have been an adverse witness to the official version, since the wound angles did not match the ballistic direction of a shot from the rooming house. Her death also closely coincided with the reopening of the Tennessee State Court review of Ray's conviction based on a guilty plea required by a Sixth Circuit decision. The judge in that case reportedly refused to allow witnesses from beyond a 100-mile radius from the courtroom. The man convicted of shooting King's mother was Marcus Wayne Chenault. His emotional effect following the murder was unusual. Grinning, he asked if he had hit anyone. He had reportedly been dropped off at the church by people he knew in Ohio. While at Ohio State University, he was part of a group known as The Troop, run by a black minister and gun collector who used the name Rabbi Emmanuel Israel, although his birth name was David Hill. This man, described in the press as a mentor for Chenault, left the area immediately after the shooting. And in the same period, Rabbi Hill traveled from Ohio to Guyana and set up Hilltown, using similar aliases and preaching the same message of a black Hebrew elite. Chenault confided to SCLC leaders that he was one of many killers who were working to assassinate a long list of black leadership. The names he said were on this list coincided with similar death lists distributed by the KKK and linked to the COINTELPRO operations in the 60s. So we're almost at the very end, so we might as well finish, right?
Yeah.
So I've mentioned Bo Gritz multiple times, and I at least want to say his perspective, because ever since I listened to this, it's somewhat resonated with me because it's plausible enough to me. And he was, I also think it's important that he's a former Special Forces officer and Green Beret commander, and there were over 300 Green Berets present at Jonestown. And to me, I assume he has insider knowledge mm-hmm. based on that fact. You know, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but that's how it seems. And so following his formal retirement at the rank of lieutenant colonel in 79, he was the one who trained the Afghan Mujahideen in America on behalf of the government, right? And in an interview in regard to his books, Called to Serve and A Nation Betrayed in 1995, he said, "A few weeks ago, there was a report out of Montreal about people winning cases against the CIA because they were utterly abused in the mental health clinic that was set up by the CIA in Canada. That all came down under Alan Dulles, who tried to make a Manchurian candidate. I think the Jonestown incident was an extension of, in search of, the Manchurian candidate. I think those people were conditioned to act in certain ways and would have probably just moved from Montreal to Guyana in this case. You look at Jim Jones' background carefully, he had a lot of intelligence contacts there for doing exactly what he did." Interviewer asked him, "Did it go haywire?" Bo Gritz says, "Of course it went haywire. God be praised. Just like the Montreal Health Institute, it self-destructs because it's not good in its essence. Most of these folks involved were street people, so they didn't have people who knew where they were or were concerned about their well-being. It escalated once they killed Congressman Leo Ryan. Basically, they had no other way to go, so they just tried to self-destruct the whole mission. And that means the death of hundreds of people. As I point out in the book, the medical examiner made some startling statements, Dr. Leslie Mutu, and he wouldn't even allow the bodies to be properly examined when they were brought back to the East Coast and turned in. So obviously, it was a cover-up. Jonestown, I think, was an extension of MKUltra from the CIA, and there are probably other experiments going on. Alan Dulles is dead. But that doesn't mean that the idea of controlling people's minds and behavior is dead. And I still think that is a goal." Oh, Bo Gritz. But when I was researching the McMartin, right? And I think it was actually when I was doing the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, I stumbled on Alex Constantine, and I was reading some of his work about all of those connections. And man, if he didn't perfectly craft this portion of his series of articles with an aside about Jonestown, and it's so perfect, man. And, so I would have included this in my own if I would have found it earlier, but so he basically makes these additional connections of Jonestown being a CIA MK Ultra cult, you know, and he, so the testimony before the 1977 Church Committee's probe of the CIA hinted that as of 1963, and we've covered this multiple times, that MK Ultra was driven underground, right? And that it was abandoned, you know, from the military and academic laboratories who were fearing exposure. And it was, and it basically subsequently mushroomed in cities across the country. And confirmation arrived in 1980 when Joseph Holsinger, right? He claimed what I've said multiple times now, that basically the allegation, you know, was made at that colloquium of psychologists in San Francisco on psychosocial implications of the Jonestown phenomenon. And he basically said, you know, citing the penal colony written by that Berkeley psychologist, that it had been, you know, he was emphasizing the fact that it had been terminated from those institutions and basically driven underground into private cult groups, including People's Temple. And this part was just extraordinary research in my mind, because it seems to me like the real story of what happened at Jonestown. And he basically describes that Jonestown had its gray eminence in Dr. Lawrence Laird Layton of the University of California at Berkeley, formerly a chemist for the Manhattan Project and head of the Army's Chemical Warfare Research Division in the early 1950s. Larry Layton, his son, led the death squad that murdered Congressman Leo Ryan, who'd arrived at Guyana to investigate the cult. Michael Myers, author of the book, Was Jonestown a CIA Medical Experiment? He scavenged for information on People's Temple for 6 years and concluded the Jonestown experiment was conceived by Dr. Layton, staffed by Dr. Layton, and financed by Dr. Layton. It was as much his project as it was Jim Jones. Though it was essential for him to remain in the background for security reasons, Dr. Layton maintained contact with and even control of the experiment through his wife and children. The African-American cult had at its core a Caucasian inner circle composed of Dr. Layton's family and in-laws. The press was blind to obvious CIA connections, but survivors of the carnage in Guyana followed the leads and maintained that Jim Jones was an employee, servant, agent, or operative of the Central Intelligence Agency from 1963, the year the agency turned to cult cutouts to conceal MKUltra mind control activities, until 1978. In October 1981, the survivors of Jonestown filed a $63 million lawsuit against Secretary of State Cyrus Vance and Stansfield Turner, former director of the CIA, a teacher at the University of Maryland, and a director of the Monsanto Corporation. The suit, filed in U.S. District Court in San Francisco, accused Turner of conspiring with agency operatives to enhance the economic and political powers of James Warren Jones and of conducting mind control and drug experimentation on the Temple flock. The suit was dismissed 4 months later for failure to prosecute timely. All requests for an appeal were denied. Ligatures of the CIA clung to the cults. Much of the violence that has since exploded across the front pages was incited by CIA academics at leading universities. It is beginning to dawn on the psychiatric community at large that the CIA's mind control clique is a menace reminiscent of Nazi medical experimentation. In 1993, Dr. Corydon Hammond, a professor at the University of Utah School of Medicine, conducted a seminar on federally funded mind control experiments. Topics covered by Hammond included brainwashing, post-hypnotic programming, and the induction of multiple personalities by the CIA. Hammond contended that the cult underground has roots in Nazi Germany and that the CIA's cult mind control techniques were based upon those of Nazi scientists recruited by the CIA for Cold Warfare. Researcher Lenny Lapin estimates in Mass Murderers in White Coats that 5,000 Nazis resettled in the U.S. after World War II. Hammond was forced to drop this line of inquiry by professional ridicule, especially from the CIA's False Memory Syndrome Foundation and a barrage of death threats. He ends this little segment with the mass hysteria and false memory bromides disseminated by the establishment press, obscure federal and academic connections to the mind control cults, which are defended largely by organized pedophiles, cultists, and hired guns of psychiatry. An ambitious disinformation gambit has led the world at large to side with cultists operating under federal protection. I just think there's absolutely, in my mind, I'm fairly certain. I'll be honest, man. Like MK Ultra all day, right?
Yeah.
I believe Jim Jones was an asset of, I mean, who knows if it was the CIA as early as when he was 15 doing those. I mean, it's possible. Yeah. But I just think that the Dan Mitrione connection as the police chief getting him out of trouble when he was a kid, mm-hmm. I think that he was potentially a part of the CIA talent spotting program, right? Which mm-hmm. has come up over and over again with people like Barry Seal and especially guys who went through the Civil Air Patrol unit of David Ferry and all of that. I mean, it seems like they also have very unusual borderline sexual relationships with their handlers who bring them in at when they're children into these projects. And I believe it is a part of that. They spotted him with all sharing all the characteristics of MK Ultra, you know, or as of a useful asset, right?
Grooming them. Yeah.
Groom them. It's exactly what happened. And I mean, David Ferry allegedly even, you know, had a sexual relationship with Oswald when he was young, man, you know? And so for me, it seems like it fits the same pattern recognition playbook that we talk about every time we have a conversation, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And it looks like Jim Jones fits that profile to a T. You know,
absolutely. Yeah. That totally would make sense. So, I think that's it then, man. So I think we finished the series. So tell people where they can find you at.
All right. All right, brother. So the podcast streams on basically all audio platforms, and, it's called the Underclass Podcast. And yeah, I basically cover things like this, right? I try to offer a plausible alternative narrative with as much cold hard facts, you know, at least I try and reinforce my alternative narrative as much as I can, but I usually don't include things that haven't already convinced me, right? Mm-hmm. And so I try and be honest in that way, and I never try to make up someone's mind for them. Clearly, you should research this on your own before making any decision and coming to a conclusion. But I will say that after as much as I've read on Jonestown, I mean, it's the prime example, the most clear example of MKUltra in the cults, in the underground. But so, yeah. Fine. Please, listen to some of my episodes. Hopefully you'll enjoy them. But yeah, they're typically in the vein of this MK Ultra You know, I've been kind of very interested in the Manchurian Candidate programs and how they've continued to evolve over the years, because it seems like they just went underground as well. So, you know, we'll find out hopefully. But anyway, yeah, so yeah. It's called the Underclass Podcast.
Yeah, you wanna, once you start getting to like what it's turned into more modern day, obviously because of that you get a lot less more substantive sources essentially, but it gets a lot darker is what it seems like. So because you can just extrapolate from the things we're talking about today to now and kind of figure out, like, if you look at things like Gladio, Phoenix, stuff like this, you start extrapolating from there and start looking at some of the things we see in modern day, it gets kind of dark. Like, where have these things gone? But with that, definitely go check out Austin's podcast. If you want to check out mine, I'm on YouTube, all the major all bucketers. I'm on Rumble as well. You can follow me on Twitter at Tower Gang Jose. Make sure to like, share, subscribe, comment, all that stuff. If you want to support my content, patreon.com/NoWayJose2020. Like, share, subscribe, comment, all that good stuff. And with that, we are out.